Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heard on the Street, Street Fights podcast, where we uncover the stories behind the companies, and more importantly, the people that constitute this sector of media and advertising that we all call local. So where are they from? What makes them tick? What business and life lessons can we draw from that? So I'm Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and our guest today is John McPheeters, co-founder and CEO of Stadium Goods, which is an innovator in online and offline commerce, particularly around the opportune sub-vertical that is sneakers. And before that, John has had an established career in different parts of the online commerce value chain. So we talked to John from our studio in San Francisco about that journey, what he's learned from it, and what we can all take away from that. So here's our discussion with John McPheeters. John, welcome to the program.
No, thanks for having me, Mike. Happy to be here.
Sure. So we have a lot to talk about, including diving deeper on all those things I just mentioned. But first, let's start with the present. So tell us a bit about yourself and Stadium Goods.
I'm the CEO, co-founder of Stadium Goods. We are a retail marketplace, which means we have brick and mortar components, but we also sell online. The marketplace model is similar to old-fashioned consignment in a lot of ways. We're selling goods on behalf of a huge community of sellers, people that are bringing these goods to us to sell, but we are indeed holding the inventory. So everything is in our hands, in our possession, and then we sell it either through our store, our .com, our app, through other platforms like Tmall and Amazon and Farfetch. We have a lot of partnerships that aid us in that mission. We're a retail marketplace.
And that model and consignment in particular seems to make a lot of sense and be aligned with the product itself, which of course has a great deal of nuance and these kind of, it's gotten very bespoke in some ways, for lack of a better term, in the kind of the sneaker world. So I think your timing is excellent. So I want to circle back to a lot of that and the strategic positioning. But first, as we like to do on the show, let's go back in time and talk about how you got to this point. So let's start at the beginning. Tell us about the path that kind of brought you into the world of e-commerce and the sneaker industry in particular, and you know, characterize that time in your life for us.
For sure. So, you know, it's funny. I never intended in any way to invest this much time or energy into sneakers, but I was talking to my mom about it prior to starting Stadium Goods, and literally since I was like 9 years old, I was into sneakers. I'll date myself. I was born 79. Back then it was Bo Jackson's, yep, early round of Jordans, Air Maxes, the first edition of the Air Maxes that really caught my attention. And since then, I mean, you can't argue how that industry has changed.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where a lot of my interest came from. But growing up in New York, it was a big part of how we defined ourselves, how we were trying to be fashionable in high school and beyond that. And that carried for a long time. So I went to school in Boston at Boston University. When I graduated, albeit a little late, I spent an extra year up there unexpectedly. I ended up moving to Japan for a little under 2 years. And that was at a time, it was around 2001, 2002, when so much was going on out there. You had all these brands that were really driving a ton of heat in Japan, like Bathing Ape and brands from out here in New York that had made their way out to Japan. And it was definitely like a booming era and a great time to see kind of an inside line on what was happening in this industry. At the same time, brands and sneaker companies were putting out different product into different markets. It's not quite the same anymore, but shoes going to Japan were not in the U.S. And they were, shoes in the U.K. were not in Japan. It was a very Easter egg kind of place to be.
Yeah.
And I was working in the music industry, so I kind of had a front seat to a lot of that stuff. So while I was out there, I met someone who would end up founding Flight Club later on. And that kind of plugged me into a lot of the things that were happening in the sneaker business. And when I came back to the U.S. a couple years later, it was something that I started working towards.
Nice.
So fast forward a couple of years, come back. I got involved with a family business startup for a good handful of years. And when Flight Club started kicking around, I was involved over there as well in a marketing capacity. Did both of those things for quite some time. At some point, that startup, which was in the media measurement space, actually tanked. It was measuring magazines, and the magazine industry was having a really it was early days of the last days.
I worked in the magazine. I was a reporter at Forbes magazine, the actual print one, a long time ago. So I know that time period very well.
Yeah, we were trying to do sort of like, if you're familiar with MRI, like that type of data, audience data and metrics. And we got pretty far with it. But at some point that folded up and I ended up, I was doing marketing type work for Flight Club, and I had a bunch of other little side projects. I ended up taking a part-time gig at an agency where I was running brand marketing for a Tanqueray project. And that was my sort of first foray into the agency business. And I realized at that point, as I was doing that, that I have an incredible talent for project management. So when I first it was Tanqueray, then it was Cohiba, then it was Heineken. I kind of turned into one of the like an agency pack mule that could just handle a ton of clients and accounts, and kind of came into my own in terms of how I work. Which I feel like I was always a hard worker, but I learned a lot more about juggling different things and staying on track. And then me and a couple of the guys over there had an opportunity to pitch Nike on a tiny little piece of social media business around, they were doing a release for Project Red, Red Laces during the World Cup. I'm going to butcher the year, but at some point.
A year that ended in 2004 or 2008 probably.
It was eight. It was a very interesting time when, it might have even been after that, when brands started really embracing social media. And that little project parlayed into us winning Nike social media business across a huge number of their platforms. So very quickly, it went from this tiny little project to us running Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Tumblr, even in some situations, for a huge chunk of the different outbound channels. At the time, Nike was super siloed, so you had like Nike basketball was, and it still is in a lot of ways, but Nike basketball was its own department. There's North America, there's global. It spiders out into a ton of different communication streams, but no one was really paying attention to at Nike at the time because it was kind of outside of the silo. So we got to work on at Nike work, and then that played off very nicely into some of these other channels as well, and it turned into a big piece of agency business. Ran that for a good number of years. And I, great friends over there, and they're still some of my best friends at that agency, an agency called Team Epiphany in New York. And I love the work and love the time, but I didn't want to work for other brands. I didn't really want to make my money that way. I wanted to build something. I've always saw myself as a builder. So I left that work at some point, and albeit pretty lucrative work at the time, to double down over at Flight Club and really dig in and put the tools to it at a time when the sneaker business was definitely on the rise. Spent a good number of years over there, had some good times. And then at some point things went the other direction and it was time for me to leave and find a new path. My partner Jed in Stadium Goods, Jed Stiller, he's someone that I've known for probably about 20 years now, really long time. We've been friends. We worked together at that agency. We have a lot of history prior to Stadium Goods. And during my tenure at Flight Club, we were lucky enough to get involved in a startup called Swarm Mobile that was early days of retail beacon technology. So we set up a sales team, and it was kind of one of these it wasn't really like we got paid or made money. We kind of earned in to the company and got involved. And that company was lucky enough to sell to Groupon at the end of 2014. So that sort of paved the way, put some wind in our sails, paved the way for Jed and I to go off on our own and figure out what our next step was. So early 2015, I left and we hunkered down and we tried to figure out what our next move was. And after a lot of deliberation, it turned out to be Stadium Goods.
Nice.
So here we are.
Now, anyway, another thing you said when you were talking about kind of that like late 80s shoe culture. And by the way, I was born in 77, so I was totally wrapped up in that time period too. And I remember one of the first shoes that pair of shoes that I got that I was so excited about were the Bo Jackson Cross Trainers. Which leads to my next question on the subject of cross training. One thing we like to discuss on the show is like cross training for like executives and founders and entrepreneurs, you know, and throughout your career, the career that you just told us about, you know, you're picking up different skills, whether they be technical, whether they be marketing. You mentioned project management and you found that skill through that journey. So overall, how does that like mosaic look in terms of like the cross training, technical, managerial, strategic, et cetera?
So the agency business is an incredible place to pick up all of those, a lot of those skills.
Yep.
You project management, which is essential, right? You learn how to present things to different stakeholders. You have the agency owners, you have the clients that you're working with, a lot of different lenses you need to apply.
Yep.
And as the accounts grow, you need to manage a team and basically be able to rally people behind you and help grow your team. You know, I think a lot of times people don't think about the nurturing that it takes place to really get to get the right team behind you. And I think that's a huge part of it. It's identifying talent and seeing where people are strong and where they're weak and kind of helping the people that rock with you to grow. And that was a huge piece. Marketing and strategy, a lot of that comes through there as well in terms of how you present ideas and then how you go after them and execute them. Mm-hmm. So that really helped me a lot. And I think there's that's still very much with me to my core. A lot of the things I learned at that agency, there's certain areas where I've really had to beef up in my current role in this current undertaking. And I think as you start to do, you know, if you want to do a marketing event, you want to go and have like a dinner party for someone and make it look nice and pretty, there's definitely a strategy component. But the execution, there's it's very easy to line up a lot of the things that you need to do to deliver. And as you're building something that decisively turns more technical with developers and engineers and product people that are running the product vision, these are things that I wasn't trained for and I kind of learned on the fly. I think Jed and I are both marketers in a more traditional sense. And while we understand media, there's a lot we've had to learn about what our new team looks like. And we didn't have those skills coming in, but we're scrappy and we fight through it and we find ways to cover ground.
Well, it may be a cliche, but necessity is the mother of invention. And that really resonates with me because I started a business recently. And for a lot of the reasons you mentioned earlier, you wanted to be the master of your own destiny and really build something. And in doing that, I've decided to take the path of sometimes it's actually to my detriment, but doing everything myself. And in doing so, I'm like halfway towards being like a full-on WordPress developer because our site's built on WordPress. But you really learn those things when you have to do it. And maybe you can afford a developer, maybe you can't. But either way, it's an interesting choice when you decide to just do it and learn it. And there's probably a nice balance between that and like strategic delegation. But there's probably virtues of both. So anyway, this is great. We're going to pause for a commercial break. And when we come back, more from John McFeeters. Hi, everyone. It's Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, here to tell you about Brandify Summit, which is an event for brands that want to succeed in local. It's hosted by Brandify, which is Street Fight's owner, and it's an industry-leading provider of location-based digital marketing for brands to connect with their customers. So the event will take place in LA, September 17th through 19th, at the Intercontinental, which I'm told is the tallest building in town. And this year's theme is Building the Next Generation of Local, and it'll feature interactions with top influencers in local, as well as an A-list program that's really coming together with speakers from Amazon and Google and Microsoft and several others. So we hope to see you there, and you can find out more at BrandifySummit.com. So we're back. My guest is John McFeeters. So John, before the break, we were talking about all of the kind of lead up to Stadium Goods, the things you've done in your career before that point, all the kind of things you learned. So now let's kind of focus in on that time period, the early days of Stadium Goods. You know, early days of any company is always a challenge. I'm sure you learned so much. You know, what were the things that are kind of notable from that period in terms of your learnings and also things that, you know, you would pass on as advice to any of the entrepreneurs listening?
For sure. You know, I think one of the biggest misconceptions that we had, and it sounds pretty dumb saying it now, but we literally thought we were going to open the doors and the money was going to flow. We were like, we have all these products. Everyone wants them. We know the demand is there. Like, we're going to open up and the store is going to be doing well. The website's going to be doing well. It's going to pump. And looking back at the volume that we did during those first few months, and this is October 2015 going into holiday, it was really scary. You know, we had some days where we barely did more than a couple transactions in the store. The web maybe was doing like 10 orders a day, 12 orders a day. Like, it was very, very small, humble beginnings. And that's natural when you're starting a business. It's not, it takes time to grow. And this sort of difficult period of a couple months, it really led us into just doubling down, cutting hair in our own barbershop, making as much noise as we could on our own to continue down the path of growth. And at some point, momentum kicked in, and we started getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's a real testing time for you, you know, like yep. soul searching, back against the wall. I had a baby May 15th, 2015, right during this whole starting process, which wow. kind of changed my risk profile a lot after yep. you see your child in the world. And yeah, there was a lot of battle testing that happened during those early days.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. Another thing that is kind of a challenge, decision, crossroads, strategic choice for a lot of early stage companies is venture funding. First of all, whether to take it, then choosing the right investors, and then the entire fundraising process. It's a whole thing, of course. I'm here in Silicon Valley where it's almost become a vanity metric, and people are, you know, not necessarily focusing on the right things, the strategic things. Whether sometimes the answer is whether you should or not. People skip right over that question and then go to yeah. the how much, what's my pre-money valuation, and just all of these kind of things. So, but also I don't mean to put venture funding in a bad light. Of course, it's fuel. It's a great thing when it works right. So I guess all of that is to ask, what's your advice from going through that in terms of seeking outside funding, in terms of advice?
For sure. So I believe in bootstrapping and finding things and basically getting yourself on a path, not using VC money to start. We had angel investment on the first round. We took as little as possible,
yeah.
kept it super, super tight on our way to launch. And that gave us a lot of control and freedom later. Yeah. You know, I think a lot of times, like, VCs are there. So there's some incredible VCs. Some of the guys that we work with are phenomenal. And there's a lot of bad VCs as well. It's the same as any industry. And the longer you can make it on your own and find ways to cover that ground, prove out your case studies, show what you're doing, show your thinking, show your team,
yeah.
That's all going to help you later on.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think one of the things we've witnessed as our space has gotten really hot is – there are a lot of people that have been trying to throw money at it for some time, and less is better yeah. in my mind. Like, running cheap, lean, keep it tight. Like, you don't, yeah. I don't see the value in taking a huge check just because it's there or being offered yeah. because there's a lot of tricks that, not maybe tricks is not the right word. A lot of pitfalls on the yeah. other side of that we're still learning about every day.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if it's your first foray in the space, your first time with VC money, an opportunity, and we have pretty, my partner Jed handles the majority of this stuff. We've mm-hmm. we've done pretty well with how we set these things up. There's a lot of places where a newcomer to the space can get taken advantage of
yep.
or lose their shirt in a lot of times.
Yeah, I'm a big believer and subscriber to the lean startup mentality for a lot of the reasons you mentioned. I mean, there's just on the surface level, kind of equity, optionality, other things like that. But also, I think you made a very good point, which is that you don't want to get spoiled on that money. And instead, the learning you get from being so lean, I think, trains you in later stages.
And, you know, one other thing that I would say sure. right now, we've kind of taken an interesting tack in that we started with so little that we scrapped together a bunch, and we marketed really hard and we grew it out. If we had had a ton of money to build things differently in the beginning, we might not have built it right.
Yeah.
Because you can go down a path and not really know what you're getting into. Whereas now that the machine is flowing, we can see transactions coming from all these different places, and we know what the system needs to look like.
Huh.
We're in a prime location to double down and really drive some big impact.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, I think we would have made some bad decisions if we had more capital.
I think it's a great lesson. So speaking of investing, let's talk about Mark Cuban. He's not an investor in Stadium Goods, but he is on your advisory board. And I think that's maybe even more impressive because he's a guy, of course, that is so hard to get to. I remember I interviewed him the first time I talked to him was years ago, right after he sold broadcast.com to Yahoo. And then he started buying basketball teams and stuff.
Yep.
But yeah, since then, he's obviously such a force. I'm a big Shark Tank fan too. So how did you get in front of Mark Cuban and convince him to be, just that alone is I think a vote of confidence that is amazing.
Totally. So I can't personally take credit for that. That's
yeah.
more my partner, Jed, because he handles all that side of things.
Yep.
But I think it comes down to, on the one hand, it's relationships and us kind of carving a path and knowing a lot of people, but it's also how we present our business and kind of show people what we're all about. which some of that is track record, some of that is trust, and the fact that we're just good, honest business people trying to make a way. You know, we were able to get with Mark and sell him in on the vision of the business. He saw it right away. He saw the space as being a hot space, and he wanted to get in the mix to help us out and help us drive what we were doing. Mm-hmm. So in that, you know, he's a great resource. We've used him as a sounding board for things as we're kind of making moves from stage to stage, or as we have new business opportunities that we're kind of kicking around. He's definitely brought some interesting ideas to the table as well. But yeah, I mean, he's one of a good handful of people that we have around us that are just really strong people that are there to help us in our progression.
It's an amazing asset. I mean, I phrased it more as just like a vote of confidence and an awesome thing, like the optics of it. But of course, the actual practicality on an ongoing strategic basis of having that guy in your corner, of course, is amazing. So we're actually going to pause there for another commercial break. When we come back, more from John McPheeters. Cool. Hi everyone, it's Mike Bullen, lead analyst at Street Fight, here to tell you about Brandify Summit, which is an event for brands that want to succeed in local. It's hosted by Brandify, which is Street Fight's owner, and it's an industry-leading provider of location-based digital marketing for brands to connect with their customers. So the event will take place in LA September 17th through 19th at the Intercontinental, which I'm told is the tallest building in town. And this year's theme is Building the Next Generation of Local, and it'll feature interactions with top influencers in local, as well as an A-list program that's really coming together with speakers from Amazon and Google and Microsoft and several others. So we hope to see you there, and you can find out more at BrandifySummit.com.
So we're back. My guest is John McPheeters. So John, before the break, we were talking about the early days and a lot of the kind of strategic positioning when it came to growth, when it came to seeking investment. Let's kind of move on to the present now. So what are kind of some of the exciting things you're working on now, the exciting things you're seeing in today's environment from like a technological perspective? I mean, some things I imagine are constants, the kind of strategies, the business principles, but then some parts are evolving when you look at advancements in artificial intelligence and just several technologies that are emerging. So what are you most excited about and working on kind of today?
I don't know if I have one thing that I can hang my hat on. But you know, on the one hand, on the analog side, I'm super excited about retail, and I think having been through from the early days to now and seeing how our retail situation has changed and how it's grown and how much of an audience we have in store, that's really exciting for me. I think given that I would have assumed that we wouldn't have been able to hit success like that in retail today, and for us, there's a big piece there that's like a retail component that we're working on. That's as we grow it, that's going to be really fun. The next piece that really, really, really excites me deep to my core is international growth. Hmm. We're looking at a bunch of different markets. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about our industry and any industry where there's disruption is you have all these much larger players that can't move fast enough to really take advantage of opportunities. I think in that's where a lot of the opportunity is. And you take China as example. We do good business in China, pretty big volume. And it's a very unique value proposition that we have because people don't trust product that comes from China that are in China in a lot of situations. So they're buying product from us because we're in the US. They know that it's fully authenticated and legitimate and it's turned into a really nice channel. And at the same time, because of how brands distribute product into different markets, a lot of kids in these different countries can't get the stuff they actually want, the stuff that they see in videos and on TV and on social media. It doesn't exist in market. And that's even true domestically here in B, C, and D markets sometimes. But so for us, adding that layer of efficiency and taking it the distance around the world is a huge part of what we're excited about. Beyond that, I think there's a massive retail innovation piece in general where traditional retail is seeing a lot of this movement and embracing new models and new ways to resonate with consumers. And that's something that we've been able to carve out some really interesting partnerships with. And we have a bunch of plays coming that are kind of like a new version of what old retail was, whether it's like store in store concession type stuff, plays that are bringing our aftermarket product in a very clean and premium way to Main Street retail.
Now, you mentioned retail and kind of the analog world. That resonates with me as an analyst that spends a lot of time looking at local commerce. One thing I always have to remind people is that, you know, in the U.S. anyway, just as like a proxy for the size of the pie, it's about $3.7 trillion per year that's spent in retail. And the e-commerce piece of that is about $300 billion, which is about 8 or 9%. And it gets a disproportionate share of kind of attention because it's a sexier topic. But everyone always forgets that that vast majority of commerce is happening offline. Now, that, of course, isn't to say that every company needs to have that revenue mix that's the same because everyone has different strategic nuances like you guys. So I guess that's the question. Where do you sit on that spectrum strategically?
Well, invert it, and we're right there. We do 90% online, 10% in retail, which I think it's even less than 10%. But we're doing really, really well in the store. The store, and we're getting ready to add more to that piece of the pie. But it's pumping and it's incredibly successful. But the massive bulk of our business is online, and I think what that tells me, like, that the way that it is inverted speaks so well to where we are from a real estate standpoint and where our business is going as that shift changes. I'll tell you a funny little anecdote. This is sort of a weird one. A friend of mine had gone to the bank. He had to make a cash down payment for something, and he had $10,000 in cash that he was kind of like, you know, ha ha ha, look at this. And we were in a conference room with a bunch of young kids, and I'm there and he's there, and I was like, oh, just leave it on the table, see if anyone says anything when they come in. And the younger generation, they want nothing to do with cash. You know, when we came of age, like, that would have been a really exciting thing, whatever. And it was more like, ew, yuck, like, what's that on the table? Like, ugh. and there's a lot of, like, so much of that change is coming in the future. People being comfortable buying online, people buying more stuff online, buying cars and mattresses, everything you can think of from a computer or a phone.
Yeah.
And in that, there's tremendous opportunity for not only our business, but businesses that are in that same space or starting new online businesses or things that haven't even come to pass yet that are going to be more geared up around that next generation. So,
well, it also seems like despite that analog heavy share, that equation I mentioned, if you can get away with having the inverse, it's probably better in terms of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in terms of inventory management, in terms of margins, online is just a lot more friendly to that business, correct?
Totally. I think there are a couple things that are more difficult. You know, we take a lot of pride in our customer service, for example, and in person, it's a lot easier to get the right feelings across when you're having real communication.
Totally.
So when an order swerves and it's like lost in a warehouse or in transit, there's some of those pieces that still need to improve a bit. But it's so at the same time, it's so much easier to live and buy things online than going to every store you want to buy anything. So,
yep. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So we're actually going to move into our lightning round.
Cool.
So this is just some quick hit questions, 9 or 10 questions. So, John, let's go right into it. So what's something about you that few people know about?
I was born and raised here in Manhattan.
Nice. That's a rare thing, as you know. As someone who used to live in Manhattan, I now live in San Francisco. Both of those cities are similar in that, like, it's a rare bird if you find someone that's from there, because it's just like a revolving door of, you know, 20 and 30 somethings, and it seems like that's like everyone that lives there. But that's awesome. So what's a profession you would want to have if you weren't doing what you're doing now?
You know, I'm really fascinated with sole proprietorship restaurant type businesses or neighborhood businesses. You know, I think at some point in my life, I want to own some type of food business in the neighborhood where I live and contribute to the community that I live in. And I think part of that comes from both wanting to provide simple happiness to people that are around, but also seeing how many local businesses have kind of been whitewashed out by larger enterprises when you travel internationally or even when you're in small towns. I really believe in that small business mindset and doing something for the community. So
what is your favorite tech product or app that you use as a consumer?
As a consumer, that's an interesting one. I always think of it differently. So for me, I'm obsessed with Slack. It might sound like something that maybe a lot of people say that, but it's totally
changed. No, we haven't gotten that answer.
Yeah, it's totally changed the way that I communicate. I hate the phone now. I don't like talking to people on the phone. And I've actually gotten to a point where, to my detriment, I've gotten really bad about email, which is kind of sad given how much of a crazy person I used to be in terms of keeping my inbox clean.
Yeah.
And I don't need to read long messages. I don't need to see tons of materials. I need quick, digestible input and output to drive things around. And for me, Slack has turned into an incredible resource.
Yeah, nice. So what is a company or tech startup that you think it would be most exciting to be part of at the moment of inception? Slack actually could be a good answer for that one.
Yeah, I don't know if I could bring enough value to that one. Yeah. You know, I'm more learning from how it's set up than I don't think I would have had the vision to do anything like Slack. Yeah. But I have a ton of respect and love for Alibaba and Tmall. So we do big business with Tmall. We have a good relationship with them, and it's been a wild ride with them in only a short couple of years. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about them, if you compare to larger marketplace platforms, is they do incredible things towards what I was saying about Slice.
Yep.
Towards helping people succeed and growing other people's businesses through their platforms. And one example, I'm going to totally butcher this, but there's a village in China where they make this really incredible sterling silver, these bowls that everyone loves, right? And knowing this, Alibaba, Tmall, I don't know, and there's three platforms there. It's Alibaba, it's Taobao, it's Tmall. Yeah. I think it might have even been Taobao. They, instead of making silver bowls and selling them online, which a lot of young companies would do to try to own that business, they went to the village and they empowered people to get the products online. They set it up so that people that were selling those goods could sell them to a much larger audience. And people actually started moving back to the village to take advantage of those opportunities. Hmm. And I think that there's something really noble about that. And for a business that's scaled so tremendously, that's a huge thing. And I think there needs to be more of that in this day and age, as opposed to taking cookies off the table and cutting margin out and leaving less opportunity for people than before. I think you need to, I think it's better when people are empowered and they have a way in using tech systems.
So you're making the cookie bigger in that situation as well. Who is someone from the business world, and that could be alive or dead, that you admire most?
You know, I'm a big Elon Musk fan.
Nice.
And that's probably another cookie cutter answer you hear a bunch.
No, I don't think we've gotten that one. We get a lot of Steve Jobs, and I don't think we've gotten Elon yet.
The thing I like most about Elon Musk is the reinvention, the multiple different plays, the total pivots, and the full drive behind whatever the new thing is. And, you know, it's one combination. Like, luck plays a role in everything, right? Like, some people that are incredibly talented and successful are going to lose. You never really know how the dice is going to roll. But for you to be able to do it again and again and again, and obviously capital is a piece of that, and having money behind you is a piece of that. Mm-hmm. But to have a strong enough vision that you can succeed multiple times, I think is truly commendable and an almost impossible feat for the majority of
And the also world. the resilience, the amount of times he came so close to bankruptcy and just put it all on the line. So
it's to double down, bet again, put it all, like it's insane in a way.
No, that's cool. So what is the superhero power that you would most want to have?
You know, I'd like to be invisible. I'd like to be able to just walk around and have no one see me. I think that'd be fun. And it'd be relaxing too. You know, you could just chill out and not very exciting.
No, I love that one because in certain times I wish I could just have it that, no, please, no one talk to me for like an hour.
Exactly. It'll be a superhero power when you can just completely unplug from the world. That doesn't exist anymore.
So lastly, just to finish off, what are some of your kind of personal goals for 2018?
Health in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've managed to get back into the gym a little bit after a long hiatus. But I'm trying to get healthier and kind of just take better care of myself as I'm on this road.
I got to ask, what's your footwear of choice for your workouts?
You know, it's always Air Maxes. I'm an Air Max guy.
Nice.
I swear by Air Maxes. So I've got a couple pairs that are like the designated workout pairs.
Nice.
That I rotate around, but not anything that's too crazy. I keep the good stuff for.
Yeah.
No.
Well, and I lied. There's one more question I got to ask too. Like, what does your shoe closet look like? Is it like a crib style, like massive, like shelves? And
yeah, I live in New York, so no.
There you go.
No. Nice. I have a tiny designated area in my closet, which is one of like the 8 closets in our house that I'm allowed to keep things in.
Yeah.
And I have kind of like a rotating set of about 30 pairs. And if I want to bring a new one home, something's gotta go.
It's a zero sum.
So sometimes it's a slick little swap out. Like I'll be like, same color out, same color in. I'll try to get over, you know, other times it's more like, oh, I'm getting a new pair home.
Yeah. It's a zero sum closet. I like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so that's all the time we have. John, I want to thank you for spending time with us.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed this, and I'm glad I could be a part of it. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, me too. And thank you all for listening. And stay tuned for future episodes of Heard on the Street. You can find us on streetfightmag.com. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And also stay tuned for lots more writings and multimedia from Street Fight. So this has been Heard on the Street. I'm Mike Boland. Thanks for listening.